massive voice of Charlottesville. This is Apropos of Something as well. We air every Saturday morning from 10 to 11, co-hosted by me, Ellen Daniels, in our Charlottesville studio, and Nancy Lawrence coming to you from New York City. We seek out the most interesting people we can find with a passion for social justice, political activism, and the arts, and we guarantee every show will be apropos of something. Today, we're talking to Tish Jennings and Francesca Calamita. Tish Jennings is one of the most renowned leaders in the country in the field of social and emotional learning in K through 12 school settings. That is, qualities such as self-awareness, managing emotions, and empathy. She's particularly focused on applying research on mindfulness-based approaches to reducing teacher and student stress. Amazingly, Tish recently presented her research to the Dalai Lama in India. We'll discuss his influence on her and her study on a program that helps teacher well-being and improves classroom environment and student productivity. And we have Francesca Calamita, who studies how women's relationship with food and body is portrayed in literature, pop culture, and other media in the U.S. and Europe. She's looked at eating disorders, the gendered politics of language, what we can learn from various depictions of women, including how they prepare meals for others while denying themselves the pleasure of eating, and much, much more. Imagine we have 48 podcasts with amazing guests just like these on the station website, 947wpvc.org. We cover everything from history of fascism to soul food, Black Panther to comedians, all from talented, scholarly, fascinating people, most from right here in this town, Charlottesville. You can download them. And speaking of fascinating people, Nancy Lawrence, are you there?
Ellen, I am here. I am here with my fascinating dialogue, which, as you know, is now being recorded for a podcast number 49, I think.
Yes, 49, like the 49 questions that Mueller has for Trump.
Yeah, well, so they took notes on, you know, that is true. I wonder, you know, well, that whole... anyway,
I didn't mean to get into that,
you know,
really.
Who knows what they're up to with making sure this never sees the light of day.
But what is happening? What did happen this week? Everyone was abuzz with the Giuliani thing that happened. So, first of all, the look on his face when he stands next to Trump is so bizarrely gleeful and devilish. But he had tons of slip-ups, again, coming out of faux Fox News about Trump's payment to quiet Stormy Daniels. And it turns out that Trump really should have been paying Giuliani the hush money. Don't you think?
Yeah.
No, well, I didn't make that joke up myself.
There are just too many lies, and I don't even like the term anymore, the new normal, because I don't want to, even that makes it normal. I don't think we should even qualify it anymore as a normal that we're not aspiring to, that we're sunk in. You know, I think this is something, it needs a new name. The new normal, it just makes us more likely, you know, to keep accepting every single lie. I mean, obviously, there are just enough lies on the table, but as usual, you know, there's no movement in Congress. I don't know what will move them, honestly.
Right. Well, maybe the word for the new normal, every time you hear that, you should just say fascism.
Yes, exactly.
Okay.
Boom, you're elected. I would love to hear that. What a shock that would be every time.
Mm-hmm.
Let alone if the press would just say he lied versus he misspoke, or, you know, the truth, he forgot, you know, he changed his position or whatever, you know, all these nuanced normals.
Right.
Anyway.
And this week also was the NRA annual convention where no guns were allowed.
Yeah.
And guns.
I know.
Right?
Talk about.
And guns.
I know, the good guys with the guns, but not in this hall. I know.
Right.
Yeah.
So the Secret Service, because the VP and the president were going to be there, they were prohibited every kind of weapon. So you want to arm teachers that can save lives, but the Secret Service cannot, apparently.
Yeah, they are safest when there aren't any weapons around, but the students need lots and lots of guns around. You know, it makes obviously no sense. And guns enhance everyone's safety, but not the president and the vice president. And yeah, pay no never mind to the doublespeak here. I know. Unbelievable.
Right. And the NRA reported this week, this is from Politico, they received more money from people with Russian ties than it previously acknowledged.
Yeah.
And it was that they announced that they are officially done cooperating with a congressional inquiry exploring whether illicit Kremlin-linked funding passed through the NRA and into Trump's campaign. Again, that guy Torshin, I'll mention, who has been cultivating ties with the NRA. So he's a buddy of Putin and a Russian banker. He has been cultivating ties with the NRA and Trump for 6 to 10 years, and they're investigating him. The FBI is investigating him to see whether or not the funds came through the Trump campaign illegally. It's just, I mean, do you have any doubt that that's true? And the NRA, they spent, I didn't hear this number, they spent over $31 million to help elect Trump.
Yeah. You know, there's just too much there. And I know the Republicans already, that they said there's nothing to see, and they're going to undermine, I think, starting at the beginning of the week, they're going to make, well, they're going to try and make Rosenstein hand over documents that are no business of theirs when an investigation is ongoing. And it's going to be I think it's going to be a big deal, you know, when they're really going to butt heads next week.
So this always leads me, this point in our discussion always leads me to say what we can do, which is Indivisible needs volunteers today. If you are listening, to go down for an hour between now and noon, and I don't care if you listen to this podcast later, if you want to go down to the City Market and help them, they're doing great work organizing and getting out the vote. So that's at the Charlottesville City Market today. And another event is the Virginia Folklife Apprenticeship Showcase. Let me say that again. The Virginia Folklife Apprenticeship Showcase is tomorrow, which is really, really cool. And you might expect they have some things like banjo, master banjoists. Well, I do want to say,
Ellen.
Let me just say, it's going to feature, if I didn't say this, what it does is it features masters and apprentices for various trades. So you might expect things like banjo makers, candy makers, log smithing, which will all be there. But there's also Sephardic ballad singers, soul food cooking. You might expect that. Master of Bolivian Mesa ceremonies and rituals. So I would head down there. I might go
multicultural
tomorrow. Yeah.
That's quite impressive.
Yes.
You know, and today, speaking of a different culture, Cinco de Mayo. Today.
That's true.
So I know it's not the Mexican independence.
Right,
but,
right.
And I believe America makes a bigger deal of it than Mexico mm-hmm. at this point. But nonetheless, it is the day. I'm sure that Trump will have a Taco Bowl and tell us that no one treats the Mexican people better than he does. Something like that is
right.
In order, I'm sure.
Right. Well,
anyway.
With no further ado, let's get to our guests. We have an outstanding show today. Our first guest is Tish Jennings. Tish is an associate professor at the Curry School of Education, affiliated with UVA's Contemplative Sciences Center and the YouthNext Center. She's one of the most renowned leaders in the country in the field of social and emotional learning in K-12 school settings. She received the Catherine Kerr Award for Courageous and Compassionate Science by the Mind and Life Institute. That award is given to a researcher from any academic discipline who has made significant contributions to the contemplative sciences and exemplifies qualities and character, including bold innovation, imagination, courage, authenticity, and heartfulness. She's examined classrooms and she found that teachers were just emotionally exhausted, so she became focused on reducing this teacher and student stress through mindfulness-based approaches. And as I mentioned, she presented her research to the Dalai Lama a couple months ago in India. So let's talk to her. Welcome to the program, Tish Jennings.
Hi, Ellen. Good to be here.
Yes.
Hi.
So can you tell us, I want to hear a little bit about your story, your journey to this point. How did you get first acquainted with contemplation and what led to mindfulness and education?
I started practicing Zen meditation when I was 17 and way before I became a teacher. And I found it was very helpful for me to recover from some trauma that I had as a child. And then I became a teacher. I was a Montessori teacher originally. And it wasn't until I started supervising student teachers or working in teacher education that I realized that my own mindfulness was really helping me in the classroom. Because I would observe other people in classrooms being overreactive and getting easily upset or emotionally reactive in situations where they really didn't need to. And it made me really curious, like, why am I able to not do that, and they are doing that. And I was trying to teach them how to manage their emotions, but I didn't know how to do that. And this was before mindfulness was so popular, and there wasn't much research around mindfulness, so I couldn't really talk about that. And I wasn't even sure that that was why I was better at this. So I went back and got my doctorate in human development and studied stress and coping. And I realized that the classroom is a particularly stressful context, and I started understanding why mindfulness was helping. So I developed a program called Care for Teachers that combines mindful awareness practices and emotion skills training. And it's specifically designed to help teachers first understand their own emotions and to understand why the classroom can be stressful and what it is about the classroom that's stressful. And I can talk about that more in a minute. But it gives teachers the skills to apply mindfulness to noticing the emotions that they're feeling, noticing the stress as it's starting to rise, and recognizing how that emotional reactivity distorts their perceptions of what's happening. So, for example, one of the things that happens often with teachers, and also parents too, by the way, is that when a student or a child does something that is annoying, it's easy to misinterpret that as intentional, that this child is doing this intentionally to make me crazy. And what we now know is that that is not necessarily the case. We overperceive that. And when teachers start to understand, because I'm stressed out, I'm misperceiving what's happening here, they can stop, take a moment, see what's really happening, and be more effective in responding to whatever it is in a way that isn't overreactive. Because when adults overreact to children, they overreact back, and it creates disruption in the classroom. And often teachers don't see that they may actually have initiated that disruption rather than the student. So anyway, that's what I've been working on. And we recently published some very exciting results from a large study we've been conducting in New York City with elementary school teachers. And what we found was the teachers who got the CARE program were their own emotional, the ability to manage their emotions improved, their psychological distress improved. But the thing that was very exciting was we had observers come into their classrooms and watch and code their behavior. And they were much more emotionally supportive to their students than the teachers who didn't get CARE, who were randomly assigned to the other group. And this is, that it was observable changes in the way they were behaving. And the other thing that we found was that the students were more engaged, which is exciting. And the students who were particularly poor in their social skills, the ones that at the beginning of the year were rated poor or low in social skills, they improved in reading, which is also really exciting, and also motivation. I can also tell you the backstory of why this relates to the Dalai Lama.
Sure.
So when I first graduated with my doctorate, I found out about a study that came out of a meeting with the Dalai Lama in 2000. And Dan Goleman wrote the book Destructive Emotions based on that meeting. And so I read that book, and I found out about a study that was going on in San Francisco, at UC San Francisco, where they were combining emotion skills and mindfulness to help reduce destructive emotions, and they chose teachers as the subjects in this study. So for me, it was like, oh, this is a perfect situation for me to answer some of these questions. And so I worked on that project. So, and originally in that meeting, the Dalai Lama was saying, if we can help people reduce the destructive emotions, then, their work can improve, the environment can improve, and be a happier, more compassionate place. And he also talked specifically about educational settings, and that was one of the reasons they chose teachers. So when I got to give my presentation to the Dalai Lama, I got to tell him, 18 years later, that the ideas and the thoughts and the things he was talking about then actually came to fruition in my work. So to me, that was one of the most exciting parts about being able to do that.
Mm-hmm. And I watched that. There's video of you presenting at the Mind and Life Institute website, and it looks like he's you know, he's maybe not listening. He looks around, but then he asks for translation for just some key words, and he's totally paying attention and knows exactly what you're talking about. It was really interesting. And after you presented a really great video from the Compassionate Schools Project, which we can talk about too, that study going on in Louisville. And, sometimes I think there's nothing better than a movie or, you know, a motion picture to really get across the emotion of something. And I think it did a great job. And his reaction, if you remember, he was just like, wonderful, you know, because he's kind of a man of few words, you know. So I felt like that was a lot. How was that for you?
It was thrilling because I've been wanting to tell him this. Both of us, especially him, are not getting any younger. And I wasn't sure if I would ever have the opportunity to do that. So I remember Aaron Stern, who was the facilitator of that session, said to His Holiness, do you have any questions? Do you have any comments? And he just stopped. And you're right. He said, wonderful. But the first thing he said was, thank you. And that felt really good to hear that from him, and I thanked him because I told him at the beginning that his words inspired this work that I've been doing for the last 15 years.
Right.
What are his views on education?
He talks a lot about educating the heart, because he feels like what we need more in our society is people learning how to be kind and compassionate to one another. Compassion is a really big part of what he has to say and what he's trying to teach the world, that, you know, it's possible for us to be compassionate with one another.
And does he share your views on the impact of stress in an educational setting?
Yeah, I think what I had the opportunity to tell him is explain why the environment is stressful, and I can tell you that. If you think about it, first of all, there's a lot of things going on simultaneously in a classroom, and in a good learning environment, it's not all that structured. Students are learning different things at their own pace. They're engaging in things together in community. So a teacher has to keep an overview of all these things going on simultaneously. He or she also has to be able to monitor what they're learning and keep the content in their mind. And they also have to deal with a lot of emotional issues going on, kids fighting with each other, whatever. And so they have to keep all of that in their minds while they're teaching. At the same time, everyone in that room is virtually confined, because no one can leave that room. As a teacher, you can't just walk out of the room when you're unhappy. And the kids can't do that either. And just telling people they can't leave a room creates a level of stress automatically that is how everybody's beginning their day. So giving teachers and students tools to recognize their stress and to calm themselves down intentionally can make a big difference in the classroom environment. And I think that's why we're seeing that the kids are more engaged, they're more motivated, the classroom is more positive, and such.
This is 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville, and this is Apropos of Something. We air every Saturday morning. We're going to go to a break. We're talking with Tish Jennings. She's an expert in mindfulness in the classroom. We'll be right back after this message. Welcome back, everyone. This is Apropos of Something on 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. We're here with Tish Jennings. Also, in a little bit, in about 10 minutes or so, we're going to talk to Francesca Calamita, who studies how women's relationship with food and body is portrayed in the media. So welcome back, Tish. As a segue, tell us about what the Compassionate Schools Project is. It's a big study. I know you've been working on the curriculum there in Louisville.
So this is a reinvention of health and PE curriculum, and it combines social-emotional learning, learning how to manage emotions, how to recognize emotions, how to get along with one another. It includes mindful awareness practices, healthy eating strategies, and also some postures and movements from yoga. And it's for elementary, K through 5, and we've been testing it in elementary schools in Louisville, Kentucky.
What are some mindfulness awareness exercises for kids that are taught?
That's a great question. there's two really important things that I think mindfulness can help kids this age with. It's learning how to calm yourself down, and it's how to learn to focus your attention. So, you know, anybody who's a parent, you spend a lot of time telling your kids, calm down and pay attention. Teachers tell them too. But nobody ever teaches kids what that means. How do you calm down? How do you pay attention? So one of the first things that we teach the students is to take three deep, mindful breaths while they put their hands on what we call anchor points. So they put one hand on their chest, one hand on their belly, so they really feel the breath in their bodies, and they take three long, slow breaths. And we know now that doing that can calm you down automatically. It changes your autonomic nervous system, and you can feel it if any of you want to try it. It's just three belly breaths. And then, so that's calming. So they learn calming. Then focusing is learning to focus your attention on a sound. And usually we use a chime. And so we ring a chime and we tell them, notice that sound and hear it all the way to the end. See if you can keep listening to it until it ends. And with that practice, they learn that that's how you focus your attention. So we do this practice of calming and focusing at the beginning of every practice. Now, yoga postures and movements can also be mindful, learning how to notice whether you're balanced or not, noticing where your body is in space. So for young kids, mindfulness is really helpful in terms of being able to notice what's happening and applying their attention to doing what they want to be doing and not doing what they don't want to be doing. So that's how we see mindfulness at this age.
So I really would encourage people, if they're interested, to look at the Compassionate Schools Project website to look at the video, because there are some kids in those classes who are, you know, out of the mouths of babes, really are speaking so earnestly about what they've learned. Just some of the things I remember, the kids were like, you know, I woke up angry this morning. My cousin was really bothering me. And then I just, you know, found my anchor point, and I was okay. I mean, just really simple things like that. Are there other, you know, examples, or what have you been hearing from Louisville?
The biggest thing that we've been hearing over and over again is how students are consciously able to manage their strong emotions when they need to. And as the teachers in these schools are seeing kids doing this, they're encouraging it by reminding them, let's take some breaths together. You know, instead of getting into an argument with a student, or instead of, you know, it's a great way to de-escalate situations that can sometimes get challenging in schools, especially when everybody knows how to do it. And it works so well. So I think, you know, in terms of the most impactful thing I see right now is this calming effect in the whole school.
Mm-hmm. It's wonderful.
Did you also present this Compassionate Schools Project in India as well?
Yeah, we showed the video that Ellen is talking about that you can all find. Just if you Google the Compassionate Schools Project, you'll find the website. And I think it's under media.
It's compassionschools.org, and it's under media. There's videos there, and there's like three videos, but this one's of the kids. It's really poignant.
The other thing, too, is the kids seem happier and also kinder to one another, because obviously the Compassionate Schools Project is intended to help them understand what that means. What does it mean to be kind? What does it mean to be compassionate? How can we be more compassionate? And why is that so important today? And with this idea that when we are compassionate, then we're making a valuable contribution to our society. And this links to an initiative in Louisville that Mayor Fisher has been promoting to be a compassionate city. So that's the other thing that's wonderful about this project, is it is a citywide initiative to bring more compassion into our society.
Tell us about
I wanted to ask
about your new undergraduate class.
So we have a new undergraduate class called Mindfulness in Health and Human Development. And the course is intended to help students who are going into the helping professions to learn mindfulness for themselves, so they can manage their own lives better, and understand themselves better. But also, the second half of the class is, how do I use mindfulness to be more present for others? And how can I be a better caregiver or helper if I bring mindfulness into this? And so we have teaching, we have education students, we have nursing students, we have pre-med students. And this was the first semester we taught it. It was wonderful. I was so excited to see how responsive these students are. It made me really happy because it seems that's exactly what they need, especially our students here at the University of Virginia. They need some time to reflect on who they are and what they want to do and how to do it the best they can.
That's what I was curious to, that I know, well, maybe it seems like initially the CARE program was designed for teachers, but mindfulness is, as you said, becoming more pervasive. And I was just wondering if people in general are more of your audience versus just educators.
Oh, definitely. People, I think what's happened, I think the reason why mindfulness has become so popular right now is that our lives are so stressful. And our stress response, our biological stress response, was really, it evolved to manage physical threat. So when we have a real physical threat, our blood pressure goes up, our cortisol goes up, it gets us ready to fight or flee. That's what it's intended for. But we get that stress response triggered all the time when we don't need to. It interferes with our interpersonal relationships, it interferes with our functioning. And so mindfulness can really help us, in a way, biohack our stress response. And so I have been giving more talks lately to people in general about how mindfulness can help us with this tendency to be overreactive that we have.
And if people want this, I'm sure if there are teachers listening, they're like, how can I get this into my classroom? What's your response to that?
Well, the Care for Teachers program is available at this summer at the Garrison Institute as a retreat, which is in Garrison, New York. It's going to be the first week in August, I believe. And then you can also buy my book, Mindfulness for Teachers, which also has a lot of that content in it, which is really available easily on Amazon.
And the Compassionate Schools Project curriculum, will that be available for the public?
Yes, eventually when we're done testing it, probably next year, about this time next year, the curriculum will all be available for free online to teachers. And if you just stay tuned at that website, we will be announcing at that point how to get it.
That's compassionschools.org.
And Tish, I was reading when you were in India, there was another project, I believe, that came out of that called the Emotional Balance Project. Do I have that right?
That was the project at UC San Francisco that I was working on. It was called Cultivating Emotional Balance. And that was the original program that combined...
Oh, the original one.
Yeah, combined emotion skills and mindfulness. But when I tested it with teachers, not just to improve their well-being, but also to see if it changed the way they behaved in the classroom, it didn't. And so that's what took me on this journey of modifying it or adapting it specifically for teachers. And what I found was they need to understand how mindfulness relates to those particular stressors that they're dealing with. It's not just general stress management. It has to be contextualized for them.
So I know you need to leave soon. So unless Nancy wants to ask another question, I need to get this in. When you're about to see the Dalai Lama, how do you decide what you're going to wear?
Well, I happen to have gone shopping the day before, and I bought this really beautiful shawl that was like a handmade silk shawl, and it looked really nice for two reasons. It matched the background of the presentation, but it also had the UVA colors. It was orange and blue, and I thought, well, I'm going to wear this because it's orange and blue, and I was wearing a blue suit underneath it.
Uh-huh. Okay.
Well, that is a reason to go to a conference if I ever heard one. I mean,
yes.
Get the outfit. Go.
Well, thank you so much, Tish Jennings, renowned leader in the field of social and emotional learning, mindfulness in the classroom. Thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for inviting me on.
Yes. Yeah. It's great to talk with you. Hey, Nance.
Yeah, Ellen. I mean...
I need a little.
I'm going to find my anchor points. You go do the news of note. I got some exhalation.
All right. I need to find. We do need to find our anchor points during this administration and bring us down. My news of note is that the Washington Post is tracking lies of Trump, and he's over 3,000 now, averaging 6.5 untruths per day.
Goodness. Mine's also administration-related. Anyway, Ben Carson. Ben Carson's HUD is preparing a rent hike of up to $100 a month for 4.5 million families who receive federal housing assistance, and has also set in motion work requirements for that.
I can't even listen to it. No, okay, go on. It's hard to hear
find
these
your
things.
Point.
Yeah, find my anchor.
The White House is asking Congress to raise the rent paid by public housing residents to 35% of their income from the current 30%, and the plan would also eliminate income deductions that would help lower their rent. The biggest sting, of course, will be their favorite audience, the extremely vulnerable families living on frozen budgets far below the poverty line. And changes in the bill will mean enormous new burdens for or evictions, for the very poorest. You know, and it comes on the heels, as you know, of the they just cut the taxes and gave like roughly $8,000 a month to the roughly a million households earning up. You know, in the top 1%, you know, they're getting this great kickback every month. Anyway, there's an affordable housing crisis, and yet the administration wants to triple the rent for for the most vulnerable.
Wow, Nance. Okay, so another reason to go hook up with Indivisible if you don't know who they are and get involved. I try to do one more thing. Sometimes I'm successful. Just one more thing that I'm doing to just help this country not lose democracy. So we can do it. So with that, I wanted to announce or introduce our next guest. I'm really happy to have here Francesca Calamita. She is assistant professor of Italian at the University of Virginia. She studies how women's relationship with food and body is portrayed in literature, pop culture, and other media. She's looked at eating disorders, the gendered politics of language, what we can learn from various depictions of women in literature. So welcome to the show, Francesca.
Hi, Ellen. Hi, Nancy.
Hey. Hi.
Hi. So my question to you, hey, Nancy, you asked the first question. I would like to actually.
Francesca, the introduction that you just got, there are more than one subject in there, and I'm curious, how did you arrive at these various fields of research? Were there always so many that you wanted to focus on?
Well, it was a very long path, and I'm going to explain you a little bit more about this. I forgot to tell you at the beginning of the conversation, thank you very much for inviting me and inviting a lady with an accent today here on the radio.
You do have an accent.
I do.
It's lovely. And Americans love accents, and the Italian accent is a favorite.
Thank you.
Yeah. So go forward.
Yes, I was saying I graduated in Italy initially in English literature, and that's exactly the time when I became curious about women's relationship with food. In Perugia, at the University of Perugia, Central Italy, I study Victorian women's writing, and I was particularly passionate about the Bronte sisters, so all the narrative production. And in their books, I start to explore women's relationship with food. So my undergraduate work was actually in British women's writing, and in particular on Victorian women's relationship with food. From that, I moved a bit forward during my MA studies. I got my MA at the University of Bergamo in north of Italy, and there I wrote a short thesis on eating disorder. And the subject was actually sociology. And then for my doctorate at the University of Wellington in New Zealand, I work on Italian women's writing and women's relationship with food. So it was a very long path, and now I'm starting to work on this topic also in other literature, a little bit of French literature, a little bit of Spanish literature, American literature. It's a global topic that you can apply to different disciplines, and this is why my area of research is actually quite interdisciplinary.
Mm-hmm. So What triggered the passion for this topic, food and literature, when you were studying Brontes and things like that? What was going on in that work?
I was very curious about the fact that all these women lack appetite. We could see them working in the house, bearing children, raising children, etc., etc. But when was time for the meal, well, we didn't really have a lot of description. No. So we really didn't know what these women were eating. And I was curious about the fact that we could explore that a bit more. And I think it's also related a little bit to my personal story. I'm a woman, and I like eating. I'm Italian, but I also have my trouble relationship with food. So I was a bit curious to investigate on it a bit more.
Mm-hmm. So in your studies, which mediums in the arts are the best and the worst at presenting images of women in food?
Oh, well, this is a very good question. Well, I work mostly on women's writing, and I can tell you that you can find a lot of fictional example of women relationship with food in Italian women's writing, for example, but also in British, in American, in French, and many other literature. Of course, I am not focusing in my research. You can find women relationship with food in cinema, other media, other visual media, advertisement. I would say that the worst one are advertisement and the way they portrayed us in relation to food. There is often a strong connection between women and sex, and often women are objectified as the food itself. Something is changing, but we have a lot of commercial going down that route.
And what do you think? Are there differences between these countries or among these countries that you've studied?
Well, this is very challenging. I mean, every country has got its own peculiarities, but I think that the topic of women and food can be really studied from a global perspective. There are things that change from country to country. Let's think about meals. No, let's think about time of meals. As an Italian, for me, dinner time is 8 p.m. 8 p.m., 8:30 a.m., but this vary also if you are from the north, central Italy, or the south. In the U.S., it seems that the conventional time is 6 p.m., 6:30 p.m., mm-hmm. but these are superficial comments. If we go a little bit into deep and we think about women, food, and emotion, I think they are universal.
And speaking of time, it's time for a break, and we will be right back with Francesca Calamita talking all about food, gender, and literature. We'll be right back. Oops, that was the wrong music. Don't worry, it's not time for the palate cleanser yet, but it's something to look forward to today. But today we are talking with Francesca Calamita, having a great discussion about women, body image, and food. And I wanted to ask you a question, Professor Calamita. I know that you study eating disorders. So do you study it from a perspective of literature, or how does it connect with everyday issue and that problem that some women have?
It's actually quite relevant. If you read literature, women's writing, but also if you watch a movie where eating disorder takes center stage, then you can relate it to everyday life. So I have become aware of behaviors that usually people have in relation to food, and also, of course, body and body image. And literature played a key role in helping me out with it. Looking at the fictional example in women's writing or cinema or advertisement helped me also in my everyday life. Now, I often joke with my students about my social experiment and checking what people do in front of food, without food. And it's a little bit true. I mean, literature can really make you aware of contemporary debates, and eating disorder are at the center of contemporary debate.
Is there more? How many kinds of connections are there between a food obsession and a woman's identity? What are those connections?
Well, there is a lot of connection between women's identity and food. Now, they say that we are what we eat, but for a woman it's not only what we eat, but often also what we cook. And sometimes it's our job to do that, and this is something very challenging. I mean, in 2018, we are still expected to perform this duty. Some of us love it, some of us love cooking, other ones don't. But as a woman, for your gender, you're still expected to perform that. So definitely there is a link between food and identity, but food can also help you out to shape your identity, for example, by refusing food or by eating food. We may try to communicate something. I don't know if never happened to you, but sometimes maybe you are angry with someone and you refuse food just to say, hey, I don't want to talk with you. Or maybe you prepare a very nice meal to celebrate something, or you prepare a nice meal for someone in your family to celebrate something. So it's definitely a way to build our identity.
You do speak about rebellion.
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk more about that?
Well, I read some sort of rebellious behavior in the protagonist of several books by Italian woman writers, but also from other literature. I'm trying to explain you and to simplify this a little bit, but in manipulating food, women also may try to rebel from the sociocultural imposition that society imposes upon them. I know it's controversial, but eating disorder in particular give us the opportunity to talk about this. If you think about anorexia, for example, the refusal of food, this may also be related to the refusal of a role, of a social role. I don't want to romanticize this illness because they are actually mental illnesses, but there is definitely a link between rebellion and eating disorder, and rebellion and woman relationship with food, trouble relationship with food, as a way to communicate something to others around us.
Francesca, do you find that there's a obvious difference, or is there a difference at all, between American women's relationship with food and Italian women's relationship?
From my personal experience, not really, not really.
Oh, interesting.
I mean, if I think about, we eat differently, and I'm talking about mainstream culture, so I may tell you that yes, we do have different eating habits, but in terms of food of emotion, absolutely not. It's the same everywhere, and not only here in the US, also in New Zealand, where I was for 5 years, I didn't note many differences in women's relationship with food and emotion.
I also wanted to take the opportunity to mention your book, Starvation, Food Obsession, and Identity, Eating Disorders in Contemporary Women's Writing, if you're fascinated by this topic. This is your book with a couple editors, but you can pick it up where?
You can pick it up online on the website of Peter Lang.
Yes, and we're gonna post it on the website on the stage where we post everything about the show. So we'll have it there. Again, Starvation, Food Obsession, and Identity looks great.
And is that in any way related, Francesca, to the work you do with Hungry for Words? I was wondering if you could talk about
that. Oh, yes. Hungry for Words is actually a research network based at the University of Nottingham in the UK. I am not the coordinator of this network, but an invited member. And this network is actually directed by Eike Bartel, Professor Eike Bartel, of the University of Nottingham. She's in the department of German, and is made up of several scholars from the UK, the US, and Europe, working on eating disorder from different perspectives. Let's call it medical humanities. So some of us are in languages, other one are in gender studies, other one are in anthropology, and many more. So it's a great network that helps us out to talk about this topic, to research about this topic from an interdisciplinary and cross-cultural point of view.
Also, I wanted to ask you about Dolcissimo. You're going to have
right.
to tell me about it. How does it pronounce that? Speak the Sweet Life, which is a course I believe you're teaching. Can you talk about that?
It's not actually a course. It's an initiative led by the Italian program at the University of Virginia and supported by the Institute of World Languages at UVA. Every year, our students of Italian, together with the students of French, and this year the students of Chinese, get together to cook some delicious desserts. So Italian dessert, French one or Chinese one, and they have to speak only in the target language while they are cooking. So the Italian students speak in Italian, the French one in French, the Chinese in Chinese, and it's a wonderful opportunity to learn more about foods in other culture, but also to practice the language. No,
that is great. I was going to say, how can I sign up? But I'm disqualified on many levels.
That's great. Speaking of language, Francesca, I was wondering if you could tell me how sexism is in the language of Italian and versus the sexism that is in English, you know, the comparison.
Well, there is definitely a difference. Both languages experience sexism, but Italian is a Romance language, so every word in Italian as gender. And so even if you are talking about an object, let's say the table may be masculine or feminine. Everything is divided into masculine and feminine in Italian. The problem is, and it's a big issue, when we spoke referring to a group of people, we usually use the masculine form, even if we have, let's say, 49 women and one man. This is very challenging, no? Because doesn't include really everyone in the group, but only take into consideration the male perspective. Also, there is a big issue with profession. Some jobs that were used to be done by men in the past are still addressed very often with the masculine form, even if it's the woman to perform that job. So let's say lawyer, avvocato. Yes, we do have also avvocata, the female form, but there is a sort of cultural resistance to change into that. And we also have another issue. The fact that we divide everything into masculine and feminine, what about the rest of the population? Some, while writing, use the asterisk. I'm a big fan of it because it would be inclusive. But how are we going to pronounce the asterisk while speaking? So this is a big challenge. But I'm not saying that the English language doesn't have. You are trying to change a few things. For example, use the word person rather than man or women, chairman, chairwoman. image or person, but sometimes it's still problematic. And I also hear people still using only the male form here in the U.S., so there's a lot of work to do on that side.
Mm-hmm. Hey, Nancy, do you
have I think there's a, at least for the English language, there's a lot of work to be done, even though I know that you're right. There is now the awareness of, like, the congresswoman, et cetera, mm-hmm. congressperson, but it's still mankind. It's still, you know, the go-to is always the guy version, as if there are no women present. Yeah.
Thank you so much for being here, Francesca. It was delightful to have you and really interesting. Thank you.
Thanks for inviting me. It was a pleasure to be here.
Good. And you can stick around. We'll be done in just a little bit. I hope you do. Hey, Nance, how you doing? How are you, Nance?
I have a good indication what time it is. Did not see that coming at all.
This is time for the palate cleanser. So,
well, and we've been talking about food, so
perfect.
What a segue.
I didn't even think about that. So I'll just go first. So today,
please.
I don't know if you know this, but you know a lot, so you might. Today is Derby Day. The Kentucky Derby is today. It's at 6:34, yep. And I just wanted to reference something really funny. You know, the call is what they say when the announcers are announcing what's going on in that most exciting 2 minutes in sports. So in August 2010, a race in New Jersey's Monmouth Track, there was a really, really funny announcement. And I just want to play it. And what this is the call. Just lasts, you know, it lasts a little bit. It might be right in the middle of it, but you will hear everything you need to. Okay, I'm going to play it. Let's hope we can hear it.
In front, to the outside, the wife doesn't know. My wife knows everything. The wife doesn't know. My wife knows everything. More than the wife doesn't know. Miss Tallahassee was third, and Morningside Heights was fourth.
Okay, well, I played it a little too late, but the whole thing was like there were two horses that were vying for the end. My wife doesn't know. And
I
my
got
wife.
That. I think everyone got. I got
okay.
That.
I heard no laughs. When I don't hear laughs from you, my friend, I feel like it didn't work. So it was really, really funny.
Oh, no.
Okay. Okay, it worked. It's really funny to listen to.
It was. All right. What year was that? Or did you say?
2010, August.
There you go. Okay.
Yeah. It wasn't a derby race, but it was just a race. And so, like, what he says, which I think I cut off, I don't know how I managed to do that, but he's like, he goes, center of the track, the wife doesn't know, into the final furlong, my wife knows everything, the wife doesn't know, they're one, two, of course they are, my wife knows everything, in front, to the outside, the wife doesn't know, my wife knows everything, the wife doesn't know, my wife knows everything, more than the wife doesn't know. And then he goes,
that is amazing. And it's had such a vintage quality, even though obviously since 2010, it's amazing, his voice is like so...
Oh, and I wanted to mention that the winning horse, My Wife Knows Everything, was trained by a woman, and the other horse trained by a man.
<That's>
right?
Good. Very good. All right, I have no, it's not dovetail or a horsetail into yours at all. Mine is Mossy List, which is they're the creators of original and clever kids content. They produce this very cool video. It's stop-motion animation for their lullaby. Sun went down, moon came up, and it's dedicated to making the nightly ritual of making bedtime more memorable, more conducive and all that. And I figured even though it's it takes you through this enchanted forest inspired by the Rocky Mountains, it's really cool looking. And even though, of course, it is written, you know, created for kids, I figured... Who can't use a few more remedies for sleepless nights these days? Mm-hmm. So I mention it. And it's Mossy List, which is Mossy, M-O-S-S-Y, list.com. Or it's on YouTube if anyone's curious. Or they have kids and they want to help them go to sleep at night.
Yeah. Okay. I have at least one friend who's having insomnia lately. So no surprise.
There you go.
So thanks for that. Yeah. So remember,
sure.
No one has to do everything, but everyone has to do something. And I want to mention our theme music is by Springtide. And we have a great show next week.
So glad you got that.
Yeah, and tune into the website again for this podcast, other podcasts, 947 947wpbc.org. You know,
Your wife knows everything. My wife knows nothing.
I was under the weather this week, and you can tell. Anyway, thank you, everyone. Thanks to our guests, Francesca Calamita and Tish Jennings. Thanks, Nance.
Yep.
Bye.